Veterans salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of COTA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use COTA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on COTA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.
Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hello, welcome to an episode, a very special live episode of Science vs. Fiction. My name is Scott Weinberg. I am a veteran film critic and huge genre fan, and I am joined by my partner, Dr. Steven DeGennaro, who is a filmmaker, good friend of mine, and insists on telling people he is a former astrophysicist, and I respect that. But you are an astrophysicist.
I'm a recovering astrophysicist.
Okay. I mean, just think if anybody spends that much time getting a degree, even if
it really is like a lot like being an alcoholic. You can't help yourself for a while and everything is awful. And then you stop doing it and you feel so much better.
Oh, so, great.
Yeah, I'm a recovering astrophysicist.
Well, obviously, we normally just go right in. The normal premise of the podcast is Stephen and I pick two similar science fiction films, and then we discuss them in the realms of entertainment value or quality filmmaking, and then scientific intelligence. And the supposition here is that there's lots of people who think that scientists are very snooty and demanding about what fiction does. But I know that Steven likes a lot of movies that have nonsense science. So I said to him, why don't we try and do a podcast? And he said, it was originally going to just be one movie, and he said it'd be a lot more interesting to compare them. So, and the show has really taken off. And because I think at one point you said you wanted us to be the anti-Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, that's my goal, is to not be ever be compared to Neil deGrasse Tyson, except as him also being a recovering astrophysicist.
It's because entertainment value and scientific intelligence are not mutually exclusive.
No, they're not.
And I find that lawyers can be very forgiving of law shows or law movies, and doctors can be very forgiving of specious medicine. And it just bugs me that so many scientists out there seem to take joy in punching holes in fiction that is largely based in
science.
Well,
by out there, you mean on Twitter, which is, you know, a cesspool of people punching holes into things, you know, literally and figuratively, just because they enjoy it.
Right. So, I mean, because I am fascinated by many things scientific, and I'm also just a guy who loves movies. And Stephen, you're kind of the same way, but you know a lot more about science than I do.
Yeah, so just to fill everybody in, when I say I'm a former astrophysicist, I got my undergrad degree from Rice, and then a master's and a PhD from University of Texas in astronomy. And then I became a filmmaker, as you do, so.
But one thing we do want to add that we don't normally put in a regular episode is thank you so much to Bears and her staff and everybody at the Other Worlds Austin Film Festival. They have been so freaking cool.
Yep.
The slate of films has been great. Their repertory screenings, they got Dreamscape with Joseph Rubin and one of the screenwriters.
Which we decided we're going to cover on a future episode.
We are. Inception. Dreamscape versus Inception is in the works. And then they also, of course, had Time After Time with writer-director Nicholas Meyer, and I've been a huge fan of him, like many sci-fi fans. Is my generation obsessed with Nicholas Meyer? Main reason.
I mean, he directed arguably the three best original Star Trek movies.
Well, you could have just said Wrath of Khan. You could have, right. I mean, but you're right. He wrote and or directed two other damn good Star Trek films, but mainly growing up, he was known as the guy who kind of saved Star Trek as far as features are concerned.
Yeah.
So he is not just a damn good writer, director, novelist, but he is somebody who I kind of, as a grown-up, I kind of liked the first Star Trek, but I can see how back then they wanted a...
It's whoosh. Slow.
Yes,
it's
they slow. Wanted a, hey, we want it's something slow. With some action and some daring do and blah, blah, blah. And he delivered, man. Anybody here not seen Wrath of Khan? Yeah, okay, good. But
you're
like
the wrong festival.
Right, like most movie nerds do when they're young, they'll see something like Star Trek II and the name will ring a bell and they'll pop back and they'll say, oh, what's that other time travel film? And we all have those little breadcrumbs that connect us to movies. You know, and Nicholas Meyer was one of those guys that I connected a lot of his breadcrumbs.
How did you do that in the days before IMDb?
The Leonard Maltin movie guide, the Golden Retriever movie guide, that silver one. Everyone knows that other one, the silver one. There are sources for people who are obsessed with...
I mean, I honestly don't... I mean, obviously, I'm not a whole lot younger than you.
Nope.
I used to go to the video store plenty, and I don't recall how I... How I would even know who the, you know, oh, this was another movie director.
It's kind of like how just a more than casual baseball fan will say, oh, he hit 48 home runs last year. And it's like, oh, God, how do you know that? It's like, well, because I follow baseball. Yeah. And just Nicholas Meyer is just one of those names. So anyway, the whole point is we got to meet him last night and it was a real treat. So, and everybody buy his new book. I'll plug his book.
So let's talk a little bit about Time After Time, this was my first time watching the movie. I had never seen it before. To my shame, I guess, I had never even heard of it prior to, I guess, seeing the trailer at one of the Otherworlds orbiter events a few months back. And when we found out it was going to be the centerpiece film, it was like, okay, well, that's great. We can use this as a launching
off point. When you asked me if I wanted to do this live, and I said, what's the film we're going to cover? And you said, what was my reaction?
I believe it was a jubilant reaction.
I was elated because not only do I was just perfect excuse. I hadn't seen it since I was probably 20. So it was a perfect excuse to, and then I got into that whole, what if it doesn't hold up? What if I kind of like it, but a lot of the acting doesn't hold up, or what if it's just very dated? And no, I love it. I think Time After Time is great. I like how it combines. It does have a little darkness with the Jack the Ripper murders, but it is at its heart a sci-fi adventure. And then it has an abbreviated but very sincere and sweet romance that propels you into Act Three.
Well, I wouldn't call it abbreviated at all. In fact, while it was happening, I was like, "Huh, why are they spending this much time on this romantic subplot?"
So you'll care.
But I don't think that's the thing. By the end of the movie, I don't think that's a subplot at all. I think that is the plot. I mean, I think there's a sense in which this era of movies had romance sort of like, I hate to say it, but there was a sense of like, okay, well, this is a movie for boys. Now what do we do to get the other half of the audience in here? Okay, we got to add a romantic subplot. And throughout probably most of the 70s and 80s and 90s, I mean, it still happens today, obviously, but I think it happens to less of an extent today. I think they were terrified that they were not going to get any women to watch a movie if they didn't have some sort of romance in it, which is stupid, but was the conventional thinking at the time. But I will say, by the end of the movie, again, that felt integrated entirely into the plot of the thing.
Oh, yeah,
it was not something that was like, okay, well, we're going to have this time travel, and then we're going to just throw in a romantic lead to have somebody for him to fall in love with.
Do you think that if this movie were made today, it would follow that structure where when he gets forward in time, he finds there's a big romantic subplot, or would it be more of an action corporate thing?
I don't think they would play it the same way that they do. I think you could certainly still have a romantic subplot. I think that some of that stuff, particularly her fawning over him in those early scenes, feels a little dated and icky to me, you know, and from a gender politics point of view. But so I don't think you would get away with that in a movie. I also think it kind of stops the movie cold for 20 minutes because it's like, okay, I'm traveling through time. I'm chasing Jack the Ripper. I got to go find him. And then, which made me take a step back for a show of hands. Did I have any of you guys who has seen Time After Time?
Everyone.
Okay, pretty much everybody. So we may have some listeners back home who have not seen the movie. So I
spoiler
guess
alert.
We should...
Please pause this podcast. Go rent Time After Time for $2.99, whatever the case may be. And you'll be giving Nicholas Meyer some more royalty. And you will enjoy what's strange to me that you haven't heard of this is because you and your lovely wife have an epic, gigantic collection of science fiction books and magazines.
Mostly her and the book side.
But mostly hers, and so when I meant when you said, oh, you like this one, and I said, oh yeah, I saw it as a kid and I really liked it, and I hope it holds up, but I'm sure I'll still like it. And you said, I've never heard of it, and that just blows me away. But you specifically, it is one of those movies where if you bring it up in general conversation at your dinner table with 10 people at a big family dinner, three or four people will know it, but they'll all like it.
Yeah.
I don't know many people who go, oh, no, it's not for me. Yeah.
Also, for any listeners who have not seen it, the basic premise of it is the lead character played by Malcolm McDowell is H.G. Wells, and he has invented an actual time machine, which this may be the first time. That's a trope that has been used numerous times, I think probably because he never names his main character in the original Time Machine novel, so it's sort of assumed, oh, okay, it is H.G. and it's a first-person novel. But so, yeah, so he H.G. Wells has actually invented a time machine, and it turns out one of his good friends who's there for a dinner party it turns out to be Jack the Ripper. And the police close in, and Jack the Ripper steals his time machine and goes to modern day, quote, quote, 1979 San Francisco. And the time machine then comes back and by itself, because that's what it does, apparently.
It has to. We have no movie.
So we'll get.
I have a second one. That was the prototype.
we'll get into some of the time travel mechanics when we break that down a little bit. But yeah, so then H.G. Wells goes into 1979 San Francisco as well and has to track down Jack the Ripper, who is now starting to kill prostitutes in 1979 San Francisco.
Yep. What I like about this movie, and I'm sure a lot of the sci-fi nerds notice it, is that the opening is almost exactly like 1960s The Time Machine.
Well, that all comes straight from the novel. Like, right. The novel begins with this dinner party where he explains the theory of time travel to people and how people are... So my first experience... In fact, I don't know that I've ever actually read the novel of The Time Machine itself. I had these little pocket classics, these little illustrated pocket classics when I was, you know, a teenager or, you know, a tweenager. And that was one of the ones that I read was The Time Machine, War of the Worlds, Count of Monte Cristo.
What's your take on the whole combining of... Like, H.G. Wells was a real author. Obviously, Jack the Ripper was a real killer. And the crossing the historical fiction in that way.
Well, I asked him of this last night because I'm sort of curious whether there are antecedents for that or whether this is kind of one of the first times that happened. It's a very sort of metafiction-y kind of thing. It's a thing that you see a lot now. You have things like Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, or what is it? Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Those kinds of things where you take literary characters or you have literary characters who then...
had historical fiction, but now this is combining historical with historical B, you know?
Yeah, well, it's... Yes, exactly. And historical fiction, but also... its launching off point is the fiction that was written by H.G. Wells. So it's a whole snake eating its own tail. So let's talk a little bit about time travel in general, and then we'll start to pick apart.
I was going to ask, I'm going to start down here on the end. I want everybody to yell, to not yell out, when I get to you, say a good or great time travel movie, but no movie can be repeated. Back to the Future. Time Crimes. Oh, good. Back to the Future 2. Terminator. The Lost World, good. Yeah, the original old school Lost World.
Primer.
Oh, someone nailed it. Knew it. This crowd would definitely someone was going to say Primer.
Lost in Austin. There we go. This is not one I've ever heard of before. We're gonna have to check this one out.
Yep. Terminator 2. Okay. Predestination. Great. Love that movie. Predestination.
Time Bandits.
The one with whales, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Voyage Home.
Not one person said the butterfly effect, and that makes me love this crowd.
Oh, we still got four more people.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see you up there, Rob. There's Rob. It's my buddy. Go.
You missed the end of that room.
Nope. No time traveling explorers, you stoners. Anyone else? Time Cop. Right now, just everyone's thinking time.
Time. Maybe it's the start of time.
Okay, so why did we ask them that? And it's because, Stephen, I have a question that I have to ask to you. Of all of these time travel stories, you've told me that there are certain types of time travel. There's closed loop, there's alternate reality, and...
There's three different, I classify things as sort of three different types of time travel. We have closed loop time travel, which is where whatever you do ends up just causing whatever was supposed to happen. And so there's no free will, there's no way that you can change, you can't change the future, and every attempt to change the future only somehow ends up making the future that was already going to happen. So the quintessential example of that, to me, is the original Terminator, where John Connor sends Kyle Reese back in time to bone his mom, basically, so that he'll be born. And he's aware that Kyle Reese is going to become his father and fall in love with his mother, and they're going to, you know, and also the fact that the machines sent the Terminator back in time is what allows somebody to invent the technology that eventually makes the machines rise.
And I think there's
sort of closes in on itself, and every attempt to sort of change the future backfires. Sense, and you end up not being able to do that. Now, obviously, they then, you know, in the second Terminator movie, they threw all that away and said, nah, you can change the future. And so that you know, brought us into the second type of time travel movie, which is alternate timelines, where you have, okay, you go back and you change an event, and when you change that event, time branches, and so you have your original timeline, you know, that where you came from and where you got sent back to, but then when you change something, it branches off into a new direction, and so now you're on a different world track, essentially.
And the original one just turns into that loop where you go back.
Yeah, and yeah, and well, and the reason why you have to do that is, of course, is because you're trying to eliminate the possibility of paradox, right?
Right.
So if you go back, you know, the classic thing: you go back, you kill your own grandfather, then you would never be born. If you were never born, you could never make a time machine and travel in that time machine to kill your own grandfather. So either, oh, right, you have to do like Fry did, in which case you bone your own grandmother,
right,
and you become your own grandfather, or that's Futurama, by the way, you know, time has to branch off, and now you're in a different timeline. And so in Terminator, at the end of, or is it in Terminator 2, at the end of Terminator 2, they successfully destroy all of the evidence of what eventually becomes Skynet, and that branches them off into a, theoretically into a timeline where the machines never actually take over the world.
Right.
But of course, they, you know, they had to make some more money, so they.
And it's really funny, though, isn't it? I just thought of this now. The first one is a really interesting example of closed loop, and then the other one is the alternate reality, and then the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, they just kind
of
just.
Well, they're the example of the third type of time travel movie, which is you just make up whatever the hell rules you feel like,
right?
Whatever's convenient for the story at that given moment, and you don't have to worry about continuity, you don't have to worry about, you know, and so.
Brilliantly exampled in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and when he says, you know, remind me to put these keys over here.
Oh, well, that's closed loop, right?
Right, but it's
says,
so perfect.
Right, he says, remind me to put the keys. So in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, they're trying to escape from prison, and he's like, oh, remind me to steal my dad's keys and leave them for me here. And so that, because they have a time machine, and so, like, the keys are just there then, right? Which raises all sorts of interesting existential questions, like, you know, is he...
godlike at this point.
Well, but, like, yes, but, like, if he then decides not to do it later on, he never would have done it. And so does he have the free will to decide not to do it in the future, because then he never would have gotten out, and... It's, you know, it blows your mind. But,
okay, and then you were going into the third.
Yeah, so the third type of time travel movie is, again, is the do whatever you feel like it. Certainly all of the later Terminator sequels do that. I think that one of the things that, so I'm personally very partial to closed loop, because it, you know, it's all so neat and tidy, and there's none of this, like, you know, one of the things with time travel movies is if you don't do them right, it starts, things start getting very, very wacky.
Well, that's why I think that time travel, mostly, obviously, it's a science fiction premise, but time travel is one of, everybody loves that premise, because it allows you to both have, maybe you have some nostalgia, you have a story that will allow you to go back into the past and experience or expose something that you thought was nostalgic.
Like the past of 2015 and Back to the Future 2.
Yep. And it can also, a time travel story can also allow you to speculate well into the future, good or bad, but it also... the protagonist being a very modern person wandering through.
You get the fish out of water aspect of it.
Yes, and I think it's just, I think that's why it's one of the most popular chestnuts, tropes, call it what you will. And I think we can all agree that when a story is based around time travel, when that is a hook, when that is an innate part of the story, it's, you got to work really hard to screw it up. It's a fun hook, but...
I don't think you have to work very hard.
No, well,
I think
fair
the history
enough.
Of time travel movies have shown that there are fair an enough. Infinite number of possibilities and ways to screw that up. But what I think it is interesting about it, you know, obviously as a scientist, I watch movies, and if they have things about space, if they have things about physics, even, you know, a lot of things about biology and just sort of scientific stuff in general, I have a different sort of view on a lot of things because I have a deeper knowledge base of some of those subject matter. I think time travel is one of those few things that sort of levels us all out as fans, right? Because time travel itself, the physics of it, is, which we'll get into, is not super important generally. It's like, okay, I have a machine, it travels through time. What's more important, or what are the logical rules that I'm going to lay down for this particular movie, for this type of time travel? What are the logical rules that I'm going to lay down? And we're all sort of, you know, we're all equally experts at
right.
determining.
You might have a little more knowledge about physics, right. But... time travel in and of itself is speculative, so therefore anybody can enjoy it. Once you've seen the movie, you can dive into a debate. It doesn't matter if you really know physics or temporal laws or not. It's just you can debate what would have happened if Marty's brother fully disappeared. Now, everybody, it's probably the most popular, beloved time travel movie, maybe, is Back to the Future, and I would swear on a stack of kittens that it is one of the finest screenplays you'll ever see. Just like people say, oh, read Chinatown to learn screenwriting. Yes, Chinatown is a masterful screenplay, but a little dry. Back to the Future, if you want to learn screenwriting, my advice, read Back to the Future. But I agree with Steven that there's one aspect to the first Back to the Future that I still don't fully love. And why don't you...
Yeah, so they do this, you know, he starts disappearing from pictures as, you know, as events happen in the 1950s that will possibly affect his ability to be born in the 1980s.
Brother and
him
his sister.
And his siblings. People start disappearing from pictures. And this is the kind of time travel that kind of most pisses me off. It's
falls into Category 3,
right,
I think.
Right, this is Category 3. So, you know, this is fine in Back to the Future because it's almost as much a fantasy as it is a science fiction. And it's a comedy, and so you can get away with a lot more stuff. Where it really kind of bugged me was in Looper. It was the same sort of thing where it's like, okay, this thing that happened in the past is going to affect things that are happening in the present, but not as if they had always happened in the past, but as if they are happening in the present. So there's a scene in Loop, you guys have seen it, where a guy is being tortured in the past, and as he's having his limbs and appendages cut off, they start disappearing and leaving stubs in the present day. No sense.
I like Looper a lot, and I'm still scratching my head about that. But it's a
cool visual. But
that's
like,
what I'm saying.
It's like
that, and the siblings disappearing in Back to the Future make no sense. But they're key signposts for
right.
the audience. They're like
they're
the audience now
reasons.
Gets the
yeah.
time. The ticking clock of Back to the Future. The sister, the brother. Now it's him. Like, but if you were half disappeared, you'd be dead.
Well, yeah. So that's why I mean, like to me, like good science fiction. No matter how outlandish the science is, good science fiction establishes rules and sticks to those rules.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Is time travel practically possible?
Yes.
We have an exclusive here on Science versus Fiction, ladies and gentlemen. Somebody get Elon Musk on the phone.
So I came here in a time machine, as a matter of fact.
Please explain.
So my car travels through time at a rate of 1 minute per minute. And as I drove it here, I moved... It took me about 20 minutes to get here, and I moved 20 minutes into the future.
Really?
So, when we talk about time travel, obviously that's not what we mean, right? We're all kind of traveling time in the sense of, we're moving through time at a rate of 1 minute per minute. And when we talk about time travel, it's like, okay, well, can we either go back to the past, or can we go into the future at a rate that's faster than 1 minute per minute? Now, on our current understanding of physics, there are some really, really weird, exotic theories that posit that there's a possibility that maybe, you know, we could violate causality and somehow end up way in the deep past. But that's all super, super speculative. What is not speculative, what we do know and has verified experimentally is an effect called time dilation, which is a thing that happens either when you move really, really, really fast or you go into a gravity field that's really, really, really strong. And what happens, according to the theory of relativity, if you move super, super fast, your clock slows down relative to an observer who's watching from a stationary position.
Why? Why does that happen?
It's a really hard thing to wrap your brain around.
It's not a hard question to ask.
The simple answer is because the speed of light is constant.
There you go.
So if I'm traveling at 9/10 of the speed of light, you know, if I get into a rocket and I launch off the Earth and I'm traveling at 9/10 of the speed of light, according to, you know, what somebody at the Earth would measure, and I turned on a flashlight, I would see the light traveling away from me in that flashlight at the speed of light. Even though I'm already going 9/10 of the speed of light, I would still measure that speed of light as being the full speed of light, 3 × 10⁻⁸ meters per second. That's a deeply, deeply weird thing that we have absolutely no intuition for, right? Because if I'm standing on an airplane that's going 600 miles an hour and I throw a baseball at 10 miles an hour, that baseball is going to be going 610 miles per hour. It's sort of the easiest thing, right? It's just a simple addition. Light doesn't function that way. Light goes at the same speed regardless of how fast you're moving towards it, moving away from it, moving to the side of it. Because of that, once you sort of work through all of the equations, it has these two really, really weird effects. One of them is time dilation. The other one is what we call length contraction, where something that's moving really, really fast will actually get shorter. And not like, it looks shorter because it's moving towards me. Like if you actually measured the length of a rocket ship moving towards you, at, you know, some significant fraction in the speed of light, it would appear to be shorter than it was if you, when you measured it, you know, when it was on the ground. And these two effects have sort of to do with one another. But the gist of it is, I could get on a rocket ship tomorrow. Well, I couldn't because I don't own a rocket ship. But Elon Musk could get on a rocket ship tomorrow. We don't have the technology. We can't do this technologically because we don't know how, we can't accelerate something to a significant percentage of the speed of light. If we develop the technology to actually accelerate something that fast, we could send a rocket. You know, the classic example is twins. So if you had twins and you stuck one of them on a rocket and you left the other one here on Earth, you sent one of them out into space. You know, they went out really, really far, really, really fast. They stopped, they turned around, and they came back. Depending on how fast they were going, their clock will have run slower. I mean, their clock will have run slower. Depending on how fast they were going and how long, will determine how much slower, right?
So when the kid gets back?
When he gets back, it's possible either that, you know, that one of the twin that stayed on Earth will be older than the twin that went out.
And they have, now they have different birthdays, too.
No, they still have the same birthday. But the twin, right? And you know, there's no limit to this effect. So if you could get yourself going fast enough in a spaceship and then get back, you could go 30,000 years into the future. You know, 30,000 years could pass on Earth, and it could be 10 years on the spaceship. And so in that sense, absolutely, you can time travel. You could go into the future. There'd be no way to come back into the past.
Wouldn't say somebody who walked on the moon in a way have traveled? Time traveled in a way?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is the twin paradox is, you know, it's there are actually a set of astronauts who are twins, and one of them has spent more time in space than the other one. And so technically, he's a little bit younger than the astronaut who stayed back on Earth.
Which one's better?
By, like a few milliseconds. Right. You know, it's not that big of an effect in regard to how old we are, but it is absolutely, and when I said this, it's experimentally verified, it is absolutely something that has to be taken into account for, like, global positioning satellites. Which, you know, so the other way that time dilates is in a gravitational field. So if you're in a gravity field, time actually moves a bit slower than when you're in less.
Like when you're at the supermarket.
Well, no, that's
because time moves real slow at the supermarket. It's really boring. No, but one thing that you and I discussed that was really interesting, and I originally thought it was a plot hole, but I don't think it is that they go into the time travel machine, the time machine in London and arrive in San Francisco. But there is somewhat of an explanation involving time zones. But then you also explained something to me before the show about how, well, even if you did hop into a time machine in London, you would have to, like, think ahead of where you'd want to land because the Earth rotates while your time machine is going.
Well, it doesn't only just rotate, right? So, right. Yeah, so that's the thing that almost every time travel movie gets wrong, quote, or just has to say, you know what? We're just going to posit that this is the way things are. So like if I were to, you know, where I'm standing right now, I'm moving approximately 1,000-ish miles per hour. I don't know which exact direction it is because I don't know what direction we're facing. But
also we're indoors, so we're safe.
Well, no, we're moving at 1,000 miles per hour. So if I, you know, jumped an hour into the future, this whole room will have moved 1,000 miles in that time. And so I will, you know, in addition to that, the Earth is moving around the sun, right? So if I, you know, Earth is going around the sun, and you know, I'm here on the Earth, and then, you know, I jump a couple months into the future, the Earth is over here now, and I'm over here in deep space.
What he's saying is that every single time travel trip should end with someone asphyxiating in outer space. Because you would
decompression.
If you had a magic wand that said, boom, I'm going to put you an hour into the future, I'd be elsewhere and probably not somewhere real conducive to
get
help.
Right, so your time travel machine would also have to be a space travel machine, right? And it would either need, so one of the things that I like about Primer, which somebody mentioned, is that they build the time machine and you can't go back to before they turned the time machine on. So like you can build the time machine on Tuesday, and you could get in it on Wednesday and go back to Tuesday, but you couldn't go back to Monday. And the reason for that is that that time machine has to exist. It has to move through time, and it has to move through space throughout that period. And so you could get in on Wednesday and get out on Tuesday, but it has to actually sort of exist. It has to travel through that time. So a lot of time travel movies, including Time After Time, it's not really so much time traveling as it is time teleporting, right? It's time jumping. I'm jumping from one time to a different time. I'm not traveling through all of the times in between, which interestingly enough, in the original novel,
And the original,
he actually does.
And the 61
and the 61 movie, like, you can actually see time moving outside the windows of the time
that
machine.
That sequence holds up so well when the whole, everything breaks down and the fashions in the store change.
And they kind of sort of do that a little here, but then they don't really. So let's now we're going to get into it. We're going to get into more of our sort of traditional picking apart of movies that we do here for time after time. So he gets into the time travel machine.
We can't say disappears. A time travel machine. What is
a time machine? Whatever. It disappears, right? Because his maid or his housekeeper, whoever she is, his assistant, is standing there in the room. She sees it disappear. And then somehow or another, he ends up in San Francisco. And the explanation that they give two different explanations for why he's in San Francisco. One of them is that there's an H.G. Wells exhibit in San Francisco, and this time machine is now in San Francisco because they found it in H.G. Wells' house. But if they found it, if he took it away, how did they find it in his house?
How was it in use?
Right.
How was it in use and being transported at the same time?
Was there two time machines? And why would he appear in the one that was in the future? I mean, you could even say, like, okay, well, because it goes back at the end of the movie.
But there is that point, and you mentioned this to me earlier, there is the point where he says, oh, why did this happen? Oh, the time zone.
He looks at his watch, and he's like, oh, I missed it by 8 hours. So I think what they were trying to go for there was
that
they rotated or something. Yep. But number one, London and San Francisco are not at the same latitude. So
he looked it up.
Actually work. And number two, again, how did he end up in the time machine that was clearly, in that timeline, was brought to San Francisco physically by people who run the museum exhibit. So that was the first sort of like, head-scratching moment.
Same pedantic, childish, stupid thought that everybody has. If Wells was so smart, why did he just go back, 3 days earlier?
Well, this is the biggest problem with almost every time travel movie.
It was multiple times in this movie. You could, there are multiple times where you said, all you got to do is jump back 3 days. You could save everyone.
Yeah, he's like, oh, we it's too late to save the first two victims, but we can maybe go and have the cops show up where the third victim is because we know where it's going to happen. I was like, why did they go back there in the first place?
Well, they also could have technically gone back and saved Natasha Romanoff again. I mean, in any way they wanted to.
Well, that's a little bit of a different story. There's a metaphysics.
Can we get into the time travel of Endgame? I've seen it twice, and I'm not entirely sure I get it. Honestly, I like the movie, but I don't think I get the time travel.
I think we should cover that in a future podcast. Yeah,
but good idea.
So and then there's a later moment where he gets into the time machine with her to try to demonstrate to her that it's a real time machine, that he's not just a wackadoodle. And so he goes 5 days into the future, I think it is, or 10 days. It's 5 days. Go to the 10th, and then they're in the future, and she picks up a newspaper and sees this announcement about her own death.
Dun, dun, dun. It's a great moment, though.
And again, it's like, wait, if they took the time machine to the future, they left that time before.
How was she there to be killed?
There to be killed, and then I guess maybe that's explained by the end of the movie because it turns out it's not actually her that's killed. It's her work friend.
It's the work friend. Yes,
who I will note, she seems remarkably unbroken up about the fact
really
that her
not,
work friend
yeah, too
is
upset
dead
about
at the
that.
End of the movie. She's more like, phew, it wasn't me after all. My work friend's dead. Oh well, I love you. Let's go back in time.
I do want to say that a time travel movie, something like this, is like a series of magic tricks. And while we might be like sitting here wondering how certain smaller ones were done, I think that we both agree that overall, the magic trick works because it's a really good
movie. I think you can get away with a lot more in a comedy and a fantastical-y kind of movie. Where
it's more fun
to
nitpick a movie that you really like and you can enjoy discussing. Like, no, but they did explain that. No, they didn't. But even if it's not fully circled with and dotted with an eye, there's so much so many clever ideas in this movie.
Right.
It doesn't, it all falls
off. Well, so then there's the thing with the two keys where he's got a key. And, one of the key that's inside the time machine, the little red key, which is sort of the MacGuffin that Jack the Ripper's after all through later, in San Francisco.
I could see them just putting this grift together. If there has to be a key inside and outside. Like, the key outside, that's just poor design. That's not a great idea. Anybody can kill you.
It really does seem like a bad. It's like having, I'm going to make the ignition to my car, on the hood.
Or a self-destruct button.
Yeah.
Just pull this key out.
The key on the inside, he makes it come back to wherever it left from, which is one of those things that's just, is a thing.
Even likes to call it hand wavy.
Oh, it's so, it's so obviously just put there because they thought, wait a second, if Jack the Ripper takes a time machine, how is H.G. Wells is going to go after him in the future. But the time machine must have to come back.
Right. And then you need the device.
Right, but the device, because he's trying to get the key the whole time, it's not that the key makes the time machine work, it's that the key stops it from...
returning.
No, the key makes it return.
Yes.
If you take the key out, it stops it from returning. Well, why didn't Jack the Ripper just take the key out when he got to San Francisco in the first place? Right.
Anyone have an explanation to this one? There we go. Go
ahead. Makes the key turn the little switch to make it's a literal thing. That you put in the key, you turn the click, and it says, oh, now I'm set to not go back.
Okay, so
basically a yes or no return to your own
why
time.
Does Jack the Ripper need the key? Like, that's the whole plot of the movie, is that he's trying to get the key back from...
Maybe he wants to go elsewhere. Wells. He wants to go maybe further into the sexy future.
Well, so, yeah, there's the, you know, the story point of...
Thank you,
He says that he really loves 1979 because everybody's killing everybody and it's totally his kind of place.
It's licentious.
But then he spends the entire movie going, I need you to give me the time machine back so I can go someplace else.
That machine doesn't disappear at the end of Return. It stays. And he said during the movie, he says, I need that key because I don't want you chasing me all around town.
Yeah.
So, oh.
He wants to send H.G. Wells back.
But that's not what he does at the end of the movie. At the end of the movie, he gets
get away,
into the machine.
Maybe, or maybe just get away from Wells.
So, I mean, well, so that would make a little bit more sense to me if the cops were, like, closing in on him. But they clearly aren't. The cops are clearly, like... there was a moment in the movie that I really, really enjoyed where she mentions... Mary Steenburgen mentions something about Sherlock Holmes to him. And then later on, when he's talking to the police officer and needs to sort of think of a quick alias on the fly, he says, oh, my name is Sherlock Holmes, unaware of the fact that Sherlock Holmes is a famous literary character. Because he left from 1883.
It gets a little
Sherlock
extra
Holmes,
meta.
The first Sherlock Holmes story came out in 1887. So he has no idea, and I thought that was really, it was cleverly played for laughs, where like, yeah, he has no idea that he just called himself, you know, like...
And I know we've gotten into the science here, and aside from the really clever screenplay, I think this is a movie lover's dream for three reasons. David Warner, Malcolm McDowell, and Mary Steenburgen. This movie could have the screenplay could be infinitely sillier, or even just stupid, and I'd enjoy it, because these are actors I just love to watch.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the movie still holds up. Does anybody here have any comments, good or bad, positive, negative, about...
Well, so, yeah, let's I was checking my notes real quick to make sure that there was nothing else that I super wanted to cover before we turn it over to the audience to ask. So I will say a couple more things about the movie. Number one, Corey Feldman, like baby Corey Feldman, is in the movie.
Yep.
As a cameo. There was one other... Oh, God, I didn't write it down, but there was another actor that appeared that was like, oh, now I can't remember who it was. Oh, MC Gainey is in the movie.
Yep, MC Gainey, and
near the beginning, he's one of the bobbies that comes into the
One of the most
house.
Fun things of watching films from the late 70s and throughout the 80s, where you'll just be like, oh, look, Steve Buscemi.
And then, this is not a science thing, it's more of a logic thing, it's more of just a thing. Why on earth, if you knew that literally the most infamous killer of all time is targeting you, and you know that he is going to kill you that night, why would you take Valium and go to bed in your own house, where you know that that's where he's going to... Like, what?
Because he said he'd wake her up. And then you know, get a hotel room and take your Valium in a hotel.
Go to the hotel room first.
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh, we'll meet at the hotel room later after you've had your Valium sleep.
Okay, so what do we... either questions or favorite time travel movie nitpicks. And either of those. Anyone?
Here, let's. I'm gonna.
You wanna walk?
Bring the microphone. Yeah.
Oh, he's
do this. I'm gonna do Paul Scheer and walk through the crowd.
Ladies and gentlemen, doing Paul Scheer.
All right. Who did we see first? I saw somebody back there. Right, here we go. We'll go. I'm here in the middle of this row.
The Time After Time movie where he was traveling through time and his craft, and then you were discussing, you have to have a machine that travels in both space and time. And I got to thinking, it's like, well, if he's going from here to here using this and the thing disappears, but then it's got to come back and it's moving in different things, why is it that this particular machine disappears, comes back, but he appears in another machine that's on display when it may be just a stationary thing, but shouldn't then the passenger disappear and then this thing, the machine itself is stationary through time and it travels similar through there and you just appear in each one of them at different points. And
yeah, how could it be in two places at once?
So that's...
That makes my head hurt just thinking about it. No, I mean, I agree. That's one of the most hand-wavy parts of this entire movie. I did like, however, how they did... the way they handled that, because he gets into the machine and then there was this sort of, you know, this weird kaleidoscopy kind of effect happening on the screen while you hear bits and pieces of history, you know, of the history that happens in between, you know, which was obviously not a literal thing. He's not like tuning in, you know, it almost made it sound like he was dialing in on the radio like, oh, now I'm hearing the Pearl Harbor speech. Oh, now I'm hearing, it was meant to be more of a psychological thing of like, okay, well, now we're sort of catching us up. And I think thematically, I think the point of that was... that the future sucks, right? That we're living in a world where everything is awful and people are killing each other more efficiently than they did in 1888. And I think it's arguable as to whether or not that is true. Obviously, there were some horrors in the 20th century. But, overall, life has probably gotten a little bit better than, for at least for most people, as Mary Steenburgen eventually points out, like, hey, you want me to go back to 1888 where I'm going to be, like, subjugated and not allowed to work, and lots of, you know.
That should have been the sequel where the two of them go back, and after a week, she's like, this noise. We're going, it. Nope. We'll go 1979 New York City, but I'm not staying here.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, she played basically the exact same role in the opposite direction in Back to the Future 3, where she is in the 1800s. And Doc Brown, the time traveler, comes back to her and falls in love with her, and she decides to go with him to the future, 1984, I guess it was at that point.
Everybody knew back then that if you wanted a character, if you had to cast a character who was going to travel back in time with the hero for romantic reasons, you cast Mary Steenburgen.
She was your girl. Yeah, there you go.
Right, and Simon Wells, the great-grandson of H.G. Wells, also directed one of the worst time travel movies you'll ever see, the remake of The Time Machine, which...
With Guy Pearce?
Yeah,
I haven't seen it.
I'm a soft touch when it comes to that kind of stuff, but boy, was clunky.
Okay. All right, who's next? I saw somebody up here. Tell us your name, and then tell us your question.
Social Security number. Right,
so, Rob, what's your name?
I'm Robert. At the risk of sounding like an idiot, I want to back up my earlier statement about The Explorers being a time traveler movie because, as you stated, a machine must be able to travel through space and time, which their machine did do through space to other planets in the blink of an eye, took them to other planets. I mean, they were receiving signals from the past where they landed.
True.
Which were coming from the past, too. So...
All right, I'll allow it.
Fair enough, Rob. Good point.
So we have science questions.
My name's Leandra. My question, and this might just not even be answerable, but in your three potential types of time travels, where does Doctor Who fit into this? Because I feel like that's just a cluster.
I will admit that I am not a Doctor Who fan. From what I understand, it kind of fits into all three, just depending they need for any particular given episode, which I guess kind of makes it the third one, because the third one is just the catch-all of like, whatever's convenient at that particular moment is what the rules will be.
You talked about the different types of time travel, and I've simplified it. There's the universe, the multiverse, and the divine time travel. Afterlife here, that was screened yesterday, mm-hmm. is about divine time travel.
Very cool.
Divine, is that what you're saying? Like D-I-V-I-N-E? Interesting. I'm going to catch that later today,
yes.
So I'm excited about it.
My name is Derek, and one of the great closed-loop time travel movies, really, you have to sort of look at 12 Monkeys as being sort of the ne plus ultra of that.
Thank you for mentioning it. I'd be humiliated if I went home Philadelphia without mentioning it.
Well, I mean, not just because, everything fits together, but there's a lot of ambiguity with, how you're seeing some of the characters, I'm here's a spoiler, of course, but you see the woman sitting next to the guy in the airplane in the last scene of the movie. She was one of the characters in the committee that sort of sends Bruce Willis mm-hmm. back. Mm-hmm. but you don't know if she, if that is her from, you know, just as a casual, you know, traveler, or if she's also been sent back to try to acquire the specimen or anything like that. Or to make sure it happens, yeah. That's really one of the most fascinating things about that movie is that, you know, Bruce Willis says repeatedly, you can't change the past. But, you know, really what that movie shows is that the best you can do is usually just try to fulfill it, you know, that sort of thing.
I mean, it's one of the reasons why I love Close Coast time loop movies. My favorite time loop movie, probably my favorite time travel movie of all time, is Time Crimes, which is such a brilliantly constructed. If you guys haven't seen it, it's a Spanish movie. Nacho Vigalondo's first movie, went on to do some fantastic work. But that movie, it's so brilliant because the time travel mechanics are so very simple. This guy, scientist, has built a machine. And when you get into the machine, you know, like I said, you can get into the machine at night and you can come out in the morning. And the movie starts with him, you know, before he knows that the machine exists. And he goes through his day and a series of sort of weird things happens. And then he discovers that there's a time travel machine and he has to go back in time to try to fix some of the things that went wrong on that day, only to discover that basically was the person that was causing all of the things that were going wrong for him the first time through. And then there's a third loop back. And you can sit there and you could literally just sort of, you know, write out on a timeline exactly where each of the three versions of him were at every single moment, at every single major plot point in the entire thing. And all of it makes sense. You could watch the whole thing. You could recut it essentially into strict chronological order, and maybe it's the OCD that, you know, it's just very satisfying to me when a movie is capable of actually pulling that off. I think Primer does a somewhat good job of doing that, but the problem with Primer is that by the time it gets to the third act, it gets so confusing. There's so many, you know, he takes a time machine into the time machine so that he can then go back even further and then the other time machine, and like there's
Primer
multiple
is so good,
ones of him running around, and then there's something about an ex-girlfriend, and I've seen that movie 15 times, and I still don't understand.
I think that's the appeal of Primer, Stephen, is that it gets into people's heads. Even if you don't get it, you're still into it. You get enough, just enough. You get just enough of a clue. And I know people who watch Primer 3, 4, 5, 6 times to try and really decipher it. I want to just mention, back to what that gentleman said a minute ago, is ambiguity in 12 Monkeys. I think that ambiguity is the key to making a good sci-fi, hard sci-fi time travel story, is that you're never going to nail every single piece logically into a time travel story because it, by its nature, is illogical or not physically realistic. So if you do have these few key points where the audience can go, oh, I think A, no, I think B, and they get to walk out of a time travel story with some interesting ambiguity there, it makes it so much cooler because you're never going to get yes, yes, no, no, everybody agrees, go home. You know?
Yeah, yeah. All right, we can do a couple more.
My name is Randy, and I just wanted to call out one of the coolest time travel movies I can think of in recent times is actually one that played here at Other Worlds a few years ago called Time Lapse, which was amazing because it was a time travel movie where no people traveled in time, but a machine could... information traveled through time. So there was a machine that could take a picture of what would be in front of it, 12 hours later or whatever. And so then it was just a little piece of information that and it had that same whole, you end up trying to prevent something, but you end up fulfilling it happening and all of that. So it was a really excellent film as well. If you're interested, go look it up.
Time Lapse?
How many of you guys saw Time Lapse?
I did not.
Not enough people. You guys need to go see that movie. Probably second grade. Yeah, it's hard to call that a time travel movie. I guess it is, right? Because you said information travels from one place to another. But it's another one that it's just, you could lay out the events of the entire story in chronological order and all of it. You know, there's a, you know, what you think is happening in cause and effect wise when you're watching it the first time, you then have to reevaluate all of that in light of what you sort of know by the end of the movie. All right, well, we'll do these last two, and then we'll call it a day.
I think we're all going to go to the screening of Sound of Thunder after this. I see everyone's laughing. I was just going to ask, but I'm trying not to be negative. I wanted to ask people, what is the worst time travel movie you could think of? And Sound of Thunder. I recommend you watching it just so you can, pick your jaw up off the floor a few times. Oh, the story is classic. The story is Bradbury, right? Yeah, but the most recent adaptation, oh boy. Worse than the Butterfly Effect, because the Butterfly Effect you laugh at constantly.
Austin is my name, but you mentioned earlier that your pet peeve of Back to the Future was the disappearance in the order, like, you know, this doesn't happen, so brother disappears, so far and so forth. Well, that doesn't happen in frequency, in a technical sense, because he's on the ham radio with his father in the 60s explaining the situation, so the timeline changes overnight. But then I get spoiler alert for this one if nobody's seen it. Towards the end, you know, you've got the killer where dad in 1969 blows his hand off, but then the guy in the future trying to kill the son is there as well. But then you see his hand melt away. But if that be the case, like you were talking about your pet peeve there, then the entire future timeline would be exactly that. Even like before the
retroactivity
even changed.
Of it. It wouldn't be retroactive. Again,
you gotta pick a side, right? Either stuff that happened in the past is going to affect the future, in which case it will have always affected the future, in which case his hand will always have been gone. Or you say, okay, well, you know what? It branches things off, and he lost his hand in a different timeline than the timeline that we're on. So in this timeline, he can still get to keep his hand, but he lost his hand in another timeline. But this weird sort of crossing,
it's
having
it both
ways. how does the time gods, or how does the universe know, okay, this is the moment in the present when he has to lose his hand, because the movie is showing these two moments as being sort of simultaneous, because we're intercutting between this moment, you know, 1203, 1965, and, you know, 1980, whatever it is. Like, how does the universe know that's when his hand needs to disappear, is at that exact moment in the future? So I don't know. It does bother me again.
Right, because technically now, Stephen, we're dealing with the third timeline, which is the people watching the story. And it only happens at that moment because we happen to be watching the story.
Exactly. And because the we're watching those two moments simultaneously as an audience.
If somebody blew my hand off in 1979, would it...
Ooh, wait a second. What if... It's quantum mechanics. Holy crap. Pff, mind blown. Is actually like, so quantum mechanics posits that, right, when you observe something, you collapse the wave function. So sometimes, a photon could be going through this slit or going through that slit, and you don't know which one it is. You just see an interference pattern on the screen. Right, but when you look at it, that's when it contains a definite sort of thing. So maybe it's the fact that we're watching the movie.
That's why you brought a film critic. You should
have
brought a poet.
About this, I'm gonna have to think.
Thank
about
you,
this.
By the way, whoever that was, for bringing up frequency, because that's like a good time travel movie.
So, last one.
Last one.
Make it good.
Oh, I was just thinking as we were talking about that. Maybe it's that at all points in that timeline, the hand is disappearing.
Oh. But then it would have been disappearing earlier in the movie.
It really is one of those.
Always disappearing.
It's one of those great little quandaries that you can't resolve in a time travel movie. If
we are observing. Oh man, it's quantum physics.
Well,
maybe
it is the only
people are
reason.
Smarter than me, and I just never knew it.
I am smarter than an astrophysicist.
Yeah, we'll have to tell Ryan Johnson.
All right,
he's smarter than me. Well, he must be, because he's, you know.
Again, I'd like to give a round of applause to Otherworld, Austin. Thank you so much for having us. We had a ball. And we'd love to come back and do it again next year. So
thank you so much.
CODA salutes those who've served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.